You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, December 26, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape on this day after Christmas. I hope, despite all my efforts, my war on Christmas, that you had a Merry Christmas. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is that special time of year where the little kitties are off on vacation. And so the parents who once had rich and full lives, ones that were independent of such banal things like winter vacation, are forced also to take vacation. Times of the year where lines are longest and airfares are most expensive. And the times were when they were a younger man, they liked to sit alone and just hang out and play video games, but now they can't do that because they have a child. The child has completely ruined all that was great about that person's life. But I'm not going to talk about that now. I am on vacation this week, but we have such a great array of shows for you, and today we have some fresh content for you. An interview I did last week with Richard Heinberg, author of The End of Growth, and we'll play that interview first, and then we will include some offerings from the best of this year. We'll be offering you today as nominated and voted in a very unofficial tally by our audience, an interview with Guy Lawson, author, reporter, with Rolling Stone on a great story he did about, it's a hilarious story and disturbing, about these two teenage young arms dealers who sold a tremendous amount of arms to the United States government back during the halcyon days of the Bush administration. You'll enjoy that interview, even if you heard it the first time, the second time around, it feels even better. Also, we will be including all this week segments that have been forwarded to us by Jay over at the Best of the Left podcast. You can find it at B-O-T... Best of the Left. Well, just Google Best of the Left podcast and you'll find it.
Bestoftheleftpodcast.com.
Bestoftheleftpodcast.com. And Jay was kind enough to send us his top 10 picks of the week, of the year, and we will intersperse them throughout this week. All this week, we will have interviews that you've chosen, that I've chosen. Friday, we will have new material. But for the most part, this week is full of best ofs, you know, fresh material today. So this will be the last you hear of me for today's broadcast, except for on all the recordings. So enjoy, and I hope if you're on vacation, you're having a great vacation. If you're not, I hope you had a great holiday. Save your energy. New Year's is coming up. Amateur hour, as we used to call it. Back before I re-became an amateur. All right, folks, here is that interview with Richard Heinberg. On the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Richard Heinberg. He is a senior fellow in residence at the Post Carbon Institute in California, author of many books, actually, and his most recent is The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. Welcome to the program, Richard.
It's good to be with you, Sam. Thanks.
Now, I got to tell you, the we have a couple of listeners who really suggested that we should talk, and you have a, you know, I guess it's a theory that is not necessarily as controversial as it certainly as once was, but you make the argument in The End of Growth that in fact what we are experiencing in terms of our economic problems are more, I guess, structural, and even in a larger way than just the way that economists usually talk about structural problems in our economy, but that, in fact, the engine for growth that has been supporting our country for 70 years has essentially, I guess, run out of fuel.
Yeah, that's a very apt metaphor. In the book, I argue that growth is unsustainable over the long run in any case, because it inevitably entails increased use of energy and resources, and we do live on a finite planet. So at some point, growth has to stop and perhaps even reverse. But I guess the question is, how close are we to that point? And in the book, I argue that the U.S. has effectively reached that point, European countries as well, and we're effectively leading the rest of the world into the post-growth era as a result of the convergence of three factors that I call the three Ds: debt, depletion, and disaster. And it can take a couple of minutes to unpack each of those three Ds. So and any place you'd like to start, I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, well, let's start. And before we get to the three Ds there, let's just go backwards a little bit and talk about the sort of the typical perspective that we have in terms of growth in this country.
Sure.
I mean, give me your sense of what the argument is about generally. The one that is sort of like contends that we can have infinite growth.
Right. Well, over the course of the last few decades, we've benefited from an extraordinary bonus of cheap energy. And that enabled us to do a lot of things with cheap oil, coal, and natural gas. We were able to make stuff faster than we'd ever been able to make it before and invent all kinds of new ways of using this cheap energy. And that gave us enormous economic benefits. And that was the growth era. And economists saw this, and they attributed it not to energy and raw materials and so on, but solely to the magic of the market. And they believed, therefore, that growth could continue forever. Now, it's kind of an absurd idea. Let's use a simple example. A hamster, when it's first born, grows very rapidly, and so it's doubling its weight every week. Now, what would happen if a hypothetical hamster were able to continue doubling its weight every week for an entire year? How big a hamster would we have? Well, answer is we'd have a 9 billion ton hamster. Things like that don't happen in nature because there are natural limiting factors that keep growth from going on forever. Well, it's the same with economies. It's just that economists have never stopped to ask the question, how big can an economy get? How big should it get? How big an economy can the Earth support? That's just not part of their worldview. But I think those questions are extremely relevant today because we have economies that have gotten so big that, in fact, they're bumping up against natural limits all over the place.
Now, certainly in this country, I think it's not controversial to say that insofar as that the benefits of growth have been distributed, or let me put it this way, that much of the growth that we have seen in this country has come from the underlying argument you're making is that it has come from this incredibly cheap and up until recently abundant resource, this cheap source of energy. And we've also seen that growth in this country was a function of cheap credit, that what was lost in terms of across the population in terms of wages and a relationship between sort of wages and productivity was made up for by cheap credit, which was essentially just borrowing against the future. And
that's exactly right.
And people did this both in sort of in the way that we understand it conventionally speaking, spending money that supposedly will come down the pike, but also expending in your theory, the cheap energy that we weren't quite pacing ourselves because it's not a finite resource. And I think, obviously, the notion that we can continue to grow on a planet that is finite, at one point, it's not going to work. And I guess, really, the question is that you're arguing is that we are essentially at that point. Is that accurate?
That's right. Yeah, you mentioned credit, and let me just unpack that for a moment. In the early 20th century, with cheap fossil fuels, the biggest problem we had was that of overproduction. We could make stuff faster than people could buy it, and people were accustomed to buying things with cash. So we solved that problem of overproduction in two ways. First, with advertising to talk people into wanting more stuff, and then with consumer credit to make it easier for people to go into debt to buy more stuff than they could consume at any one point. So for the first few decades of the century, our motto was consume now, pay later. Well, now it's later. We've gotten to the point now where the economy is seizing up for a series of reasons, that the three Ds again. And as that happens, all of these debts start to come due at the same time, and there's not enough new credit to be able to pay off that debt. And that's the situation that we're facing. Well, in Europe, for example, it's being called a growth crisis. The sovereign debt of all of these countries that are in trouble, Greece, Italy, Spain, and so on, was taken on at a time when the economies were growing rapidly, and it seemed as though that debt could easily be paid off. But now that growth has slowed down, these countries find themselves with a millstone around their necks, and it's not clear how they're going to get out of this situation.
And so, so let's talk about debt depletion and disaster. What are those three? I mean, you've talked about debt.
Yes.
And when you talk about debt, I mean, you're really talking about the fact that these economies that we're discussing have run on consumer spending, or at least have grown,
right,
or much of their growth has come from consumer spending. I know at least in this country, it's 70% of our growth comes from that. And that because, to a certain extent, we're going through a period of deleveraging, people simply aren't buying. And because we have such incredible unemployment, people don't have the resources to buy and drive this economy. Is that essentially the debt that you're talking about?
That's very accurate. And when you look at the demographic situation with the baby boom entering retirement years, where they're going to be consuming less and saving more, there's really no basis for a recovery within the economy itself. I mean, there's no likely return of high housing prices that people can use as the basis for increasing consumer debt. So we're sort of stuck in the water without a paddle.
And so let's move to depletion. I mean, let's stay on debt for a second, because I believe that at the very least, right now, the U.S. government should be going further into debt. and can go into further into debt because we control our own currency. We have a different dynamic than the Greeks, for instance.
And debt is cheap for the U.S. right now because the U.S. dollar is still the world's reserve currency.
Right, and we can borrow money in the form of when we issue treasury bonds, 10, 20, 30-year bonds at an all-time low. Your argument is that even if we were to do that, take on this debt, and even and politically this is impossible now, or sadly impossible now. But the U.S. government was to say, okay, we're going to start another a WPA. We're going to hire 4 million people, 5 million people to build our infrastructure, to create the means in which we are expending less energy, but still manage to have productivity. Do you think that second part is even possible?
Well, you know, I think that it would be advisable, in fact, for governments to take on a bit more debt at this point in order to fund the kinds of projects you're talking about. We need infrastructure in place to help the country function well in a situation with low or even negative growth over the next few decades. It's going to be a different kind of infrastructure from what we've had in the past. Instead of building more highways, we need more local public transit. We need more local food. We need, in fact, really a guarantee of the basics for the population because unemployment is not going to go away. So we need guarantees for people of access to food, water, basic medical care, shelter, and so on. In order to avert the kind of unraveling social sphere that we're seeing in so many countries in North Africa, the Middle East, and so on, that's going to happen in this country as well, unless we're able to guarantee the basics.
And so when you're talking about debt, you're talking about the long-term incapacity for the individuals in our society, essentially, to be able to generate growth. And in some respects, when you're advocating for those measures to be taken on by our governments, in some ways you're talking about providing a soft landing.
That's right. Yeah, and we're on course for a very hard landing right now because there is very little social safety net in this country, a bit more in some other countries around the world. But if the economy really starts to come apart at the seams the way it began to do in 2007, 2008, if that process starts again, which it seems very likely to do, we don't have very much of a backup, and it seems as though we're facing not only economic but also social unraveling.
Let's talk about the notion of depletion. Now, we hit peak oil in this country, I think it was around 1972. If I'm not mistaken, and people forget
that's
that
right.
The United States was the primary source of oil for at least
for the world
for at least 50-60 years, I guess, in the last century.
That's right. Yes, the U.S. was not only the world's foremost oil producing nation. We were also the world's foremost oil exporting nation. We were producing half the world's oil in many of those years. But that changed in 1970. Since then, we've become the world's foremost oil importing nation. And it's not just because of EPA regulations or environmentalists. Fact is, we've sunk more exploratory wells in the United States than in the rest of the world put together. This is a fully mature oil-producing province. That's not to say we'll never discover more oil in the United States. It's being discovered all the time. But much smaller pockets, and what we're finding these days typically is oil that's much more expensive and slow to produce. So the result of that is higher oil prices, and we're seeing oil prices today in the range of $100 a barrel, roughly three or four times what was being forecast just a few years ago that we would see today. And that's having a constricting impact on economic growth. We see it in recent economic history. Every time we've had an oil price spike in the last 40 years, we've had a recession immediately following. And that certainly was the case in 2008 when we saw the oil price spike up to $147 a barrel. Immediately, the world economy went into recession. And we're just barely pulling out of that now, but the oil price is back up to $100 a barrel, and that's really preventing the economy from recovering. That's not my opinion. The International Energy Agency has said effectively the same thing, and there are a number of economic analysts who've come to the same conclusion.
Now, just to give me your sense, I mean, I imagine you have a better sense of this than I, and certainly I imagine at one point over the next year we're going to hear quite a bit about this, but I think it's in the Dakotas that there's a big,
yes.
They're pulling a lot of like a shale oil out of, or oil that they're extracting from shale.
Yes, the Bakken Formation in North Dakota. They're using the same fracking technology that's being used with natural gas in several parts of the U.S., in Texas and in Pennsylvania, various places. Basically the same technology, horizontal drilling and the injection of special chemicals to fracture the rock of low permeability, mostly shale. And what's being achieved with that is a production of a little less than 500,000 barrels a day in North Dakota, which is turning North Dakota into, you know, a real boom town. And there are a lot of claims being made that this is going to turn around our situation in the U.S. and the world, that we'll have lots of plentiful cheap oil as a result of this. What people who say these things don't understand is that this is inherently expensive oil, and it's going to be slow to produce. 500,000 barrels a day from North Dakota seems really good until you realize that the U.S. imports, oh, something like 10 or 12 million barrels every day. So 500,000 barrels a day, it helps in the margins, and that will probably continue to increase for a few years. But it's not going to change the fundamental equation, which is that we've used up the cheap, easy stuff. The low-hanging fruit are gone. And even though we will be finding and producing more oil, it's going to be from lower quality resources. And if the price of oil for some reason goes down as a result, say, of another economic crash, that will just mean that these new sources of oil will be taken offline because they won't be profitable to produce at anything less than current oil prices.
Right. I mean, because that's really the key, is that there's a, you know, and once you start getting up to $100 a barrel, I mean, I've seen reports of there's also there's a push to recycle. To use recycled plastics and sort of get energy from that. But at the end of the day, this is we're basically at as cheap as it's going to get going forward. It's only going to get more expensive. It's just a question of at what rate and, you know, accounting for some small dips here and there.
That's right.
And,
yeah, I mean, it will be less affordable is a better way of putting it, because saying more expensive then gets you into a question of, well, what's a dollar going to be worth 5 years from now?
Right.
And so, but I think it's entirely defensible to say that oil is going to become less affordable as time goes on.
And so essentially your argument is, and it seems to make, you know, it seems, you know, fairly obvious, and particularly sort of even more obvious relative to how much it's discussed in the mainstream media. But if you take a literally the fuel that drives the engine of economic growth and you triple its price, I mean, we've over the past 10 years, right? I mean, oil is three times as expensive as it was.
In inflation-adjusted terms, if in nominal terms it's more like four or five times what it was, but in inflation-adjusted terms, about three times its former price. Yes.
So, I mean, what do you think? I mean, it seems quite obvious to me. I mean, just, you know, even if my bandwidth, for instance, on my podcast, if it tripled or quadrupled in cost, it's going to seriously inhibit my capacity to grow this show. What do you think accounts for the fact that it's not discussed?
Well, Yeah, I don't know why it's not being discussed. It is pretty obvious. I mean, if you take money out of the pockets of consumers, they're going to have less to spend, and that's what's happened. You know, the housing bubble burst in 2007-2008. The places where it burst first were the outlying suburbs where people had to drive an hour or more to get to work, and they were filling up their big SUVs, and it was costing now over $100 to fill up the tank, and they were paying $1,500 or more every month just for fuel to get to and from work. Okay, well, those houses started losing value because people couldn't afford to pay for gasoline and pay their mortgages and their credit cards. And then the crash in housing values spread from there. As oil prices go up, that makes everything more costly, less affordable, and it takes money out of the pockets of consumers, and it makes the economy, makes economic growth harder to achieve.
And that essentially is your second D, right? I mean, it's depletion.
That's right.
Because there's a direct proportion, there's a direct relationship between depletion and expense.
That's right.
So let's go on to the third D.
this is a really cheery conversation, isn't it?
Believe me, it's yeah. Hard to have other types of conversations these days.
I know. Yeah. Well, you know, this is the territory we're in. But you know, unless we understand the situation we're in, it's really hard to address it in ways that that really makes sense. The third D, of course, is disaster, and here I'm talking about natural disasters. Floods, droughts, and also industrial accidents like the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe of the summer of 2010 or the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe of earlier this year. These kinds of disasters are costing more every year. Now, intuitively, it seems strange because, you know, disasters have been happening forever. Earthquakes, volcanoes, you name it. Why should they be costing more now? Well, several reasons. First of all, there's more human infrastructure and more people in harm's way. Second, because of climate change, we're seeing worsening weird weather all over the place, and this particularly with floods and droughts. And then also, because as we search for oil and other resources in ever more desperate ways, we're having to employ technology that's at the absolute limits of what we're capable of, like drilling in 2 or 3 miles of ocean water. Right. Things are more likely to go wrong, and when they do go wrong, it's likely to cost more to clean up. So the result of that is the total cost of natural disasters and industrial accidents is hitting new records every year. In 2010, it was something like $250 billion. In 2011, we hit that $250 billion mark in June. And I'm not sure what the total is going to be for the year as a whole, but it's going to be much, much higher than that. So that's making it difficult for insurance companies to evaluate risk. And it's also creating more and more growth problems for economies that depend upon agriculture. And of course, the United States is one of those countries, but there are many others, and also countries that depend upon food imports and where the price of food is a big factor in social stability.
So we've talked about all these things, and you know, like, what point do you get a sense that I mean, we're obviously there, and in terms of you know, the stagnant growth, and there are things that we can do. So you know, when you talk about the idea that some governments, and particularly ours, to take on more debt at this point is necessary to. Create these type of infrastructure, both sort of human infrastructure structural
built infrastructure.
Yeah, built yeah. infrastructure. We don't really have a sense of when these things will conspire in such a way that they'll become I mean, do you anticipate a time where everybody says, okay, now take for granted these sort of things? I mean, at one point, someone, I would imagine, you know, Brian Williams is going to get on the beginning of NBC News and say, you know, it's not just – I just found out today. It's not just that we're not properly educating people, and it's not just that we have globalization, but we're actually just sort of running out or running out might be the wrong word, just that – or running out of cheap energy, of cheap fuel, I guess. You know, we're not running out of fuel per se, although we are, but we're running out of really cheap fuel, and that's really the issue.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's. I think we can go on for a long time just playing whack-a-mole, you know, looking at the symptoms and trying to deal with those and trying to find who's responsible and blaming different parties for why things seem to be going wrong in the financial world and in the social sphere and the political sphere and so on. And it's kind of tough for people to sort of sit back and see the bigger patterns and say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we've built a whole economy around the idea that growth can go on forever. And we're starting to hit natural limits here, and we're really going to have to do something about, you know, the whole way we design our economy and what we're aiming for and so on. Those conclusions are not likely to come to people's minds right off the bat. The conclusions that are going to come to mind are, you know, who's to blame for this? So that's really why I wrote the book, is to try to, you know, connect some of these dots so that we can see that, yeah, there are evil criminals on Wall Street to blame. There are, you know, very foolish politicians who are saying stupid things. But in the end, you know, we're all part of this. We're all part of this economy that is trying to do something impossible. And we have to realign our measures and our goals. We have to stop aiming for constant increase in consumption and start looking at the quality of life and what we can improve, because there's a lot that we can still improve about our economy and our way of life. But I don't think we're going to be able to do it as long as we continue to assume that a rising tide it will lift all boats, and you know, to be wealthy is glorious, as the Chinese are now saying. That path got us through the 20th century, but in the 21st century, I think it's going to be absolute poison.
And now, obviously, this is speculation. But do you think that when you say that people aren't aware of this, I mean, do you think that it's that people aren't aware of this, or that that the system in which conventional wisdom is made is specifically maybe a strong word, is just not – there's just not the incentives to that are there to increase people's awareness of this. I mean, because, you know, I hear anecdotally from, you know people who are certainly more in touch with, you know, the Davos set than I am. But I hear from them that, you know, they're all those people are buying up huge swaths of land because they know that food is going to become an issue. That they are, in fact, you know, sort of aware of what you're expressing, but they see it as a market opportunity. I mean, look, we've seen, despite the fact that we have seen depletion to the extent that it is, I guess, I don't know if there's a one-to-one relationship, but we've seen depletion to the point where the cost of these resources have multiplied times 3 or 4 or 5. At the same time, we've also seen a similar increase in the profits of the people who sell these goods. This is for some a market opportunity, and for the rest of us, something that it's maybe better for us just not to appreciate is happening.
Yeah. What you're saying is I can generally agree with. There definitely are profits to be made on the way up with economic growth, and there are those who will still be able to profit, at least to a certain extent, on the way down. And most of the people who are in charge of the economy really don't know what else to do. I was speaking at an investors conference in Hong Kong a few months ago, and This is something I don't usually do, by the way. But
well, they were smart enough to know that there was money to be made on the way down. If they know what the
that's what was going on. They wanted to know about global resource constraints, and there was a big discussion about climate change. And it wasn't how to stop climate change or what we need to do. It was about how to profit from it. You know, whether to invest in weather derivatives or whatever. So yeah, that kind of thinking definitely is very prominent, and once again, that's why I think it's so important to educate the public about what's really going on, so that we're not fighting at shadows, and we can address the real problems.
And frankly, the behavior of the elite. Could also be like, you know, I want to cash in some of the chips while it's still open. So, all right, assuming that I have any listeners that have not now drunk themselves into a stupor or have decided to just double the dose of Ambien and take a nap for the next couple of days, what can we do as individuals beyond having an awareness? We can sort of prepare in some way. I mean, I sit here and I have a 6-year-old daughter, and I am coming increasingly obsessed with not just what the world is going to look like when she is my age, but what I can do to help her at that time.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot that we can do. I mean, we are headed toward an economy that is less based on money and more based on just interpersonal trust, getting along with each other, helping each other out, learning really basic survival skills and looking out for one another. I'm talking about, you know, knowing how to grow more of your own food, you know, keeping chickens in the backyard if you got the space, sharing stuff with your neighbors, offering rides to people. Because sharing is going to be the name of the game as time goes on. That's how we're going to get by. And, you know, in some ways it's going to make life better, because what we did over the course of the 20th century was we substituted professionalization for community. You know, we started paying people to do things for us that we used to do for ourselves or family or friends. And, you know, it enabled us to increase the number of hours that we worked, increase the GDP, but it didn't really make for better quality of life. So as the economy contracts and as we depend more and more on each other, as we get back in touch with kind of the basics of life, in some ways I think it's going to be really good for us. It will be a hard transition. You know, specifically, you know, I don't advocate, you know, going out and buying gold and silver. What I do advocate is going out and buying garden tools and getting to know your neighbors.
You know, it's interesting too, because there was a part of what you're saying there that I just interviewed David Graeber, who is an anthropologist who was talking about early economies.
And, he wrote an excellent book.
Yes, and the debt the past 5,000 years.
That's right.
Which people should read after they read your book, The End of Growth. But this notion of a more sharing-based economy—that this is nothing new. In fact, this is the way that economies functioned for, you know, thousands of years.
That's right. When we talk about the end of growth, sometimes people ask me, "Well, what? How could an economy possibly function without growth?" And to which I answer, "Well, you know, all we're doing is we're getting back to normal. This regime in which we expect, you know, 3 or 4 or 5% growth every year is something completely anomalous in world history. Yes, economies grew before, but it's something like, you know, 0.01% per year, nothing like what we've seen over the past few decades. So we're just getting back to normal. And as I said earlier, that normal doesn't necessarily look so bad. How people respond to hard economic times is you know, very characteristic. You go back and you look at what happened during the Great Depression, during the two world wars. People grew more of their own home garden veggies. They looked out for one another. They experienced more of a sense of community as a result.
And now we also have a government that has the capacity. It's just a question of where the priorities are going to go, that are going to be able to make up for some of those gaps, like you said, in terms of...
That's right. We still have an enormous amount of public wealth in this country. So it's a question of what we're going to do with that public wealth. Are we going to continue bailing out the banks in a fruitless pursuit of more economic growth? Or are we going to use that public wealth to support the population as we go through this difficult transition to a post-growth economy? And, you know, I think that the Occupy movement is extremely important in all of this because it's a voice out there saying, hey, look, you know, maybe you want to continue bailing out the banks, but you got millions of people here who are suffering, and that we, the 99%, are not going to go along with this much longer.
And to a certain extent, what was happening in what is happening right now in the 60 odd encampments that still exist, and in the encampments that were shut down, is very much the type of sort of mini economies and mini societies that you're talking about are probably most likely our future.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've visited a number of those encampments. What I see is tens of thousands of young people getting a political education. I see people providing free shelter, free medical care, free food for one another. And it is creating a cultural shift. I mean, the people, the encampments can be broken up and dispersed, but the people who experienced what it was like to be in the Occupy movement are never going to forget that, and they're going to take what they've learned into their communities, and it's going to change things.
Richard Einberg, author of The End of Growth. We have a link to your book on our site at majority.fm. I really appreciate you taking the time.
It's been a real pleasure, Sam. Thank you.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is my pleasure to welcome to the program a man who cooks a great shank of beef. He is the contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine, Guy Lawson, here to talk about his awesome piece in Rolling Stone magazine. March 31st, Rolling Stone magazine, The Stoner Arm Dealers, How Two American Kids Became Big-Time Weapons Traders. Welcome to the program, Guy.
Hey, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing great. This story, I remember when it broke in the Times back in the day. It sort of disappeared. And this is the one of the funnest sort of most disturbing stories I've read in a long time. It's about these two guys, David Packhouse, and Ephraim Varoli. Tell us the story of these two guys and what it has to do with the new normal in America, as far as I can tell.
These are two kids who live down in South Beach. They're both Orthodox Jewish kids that went to the same yeshiva, and they were just really smart kids who had had developed an extensive taste for marijuana and money, I suppose you'd say.
Now, when we say kids, we're not talking like we're a couple old fuddies, and these guys are 30. These guys were in their teens.
Yeah, one of the kids is Ephraim Divaroli. His father and his uncle were involved in what you could call the arms trade. His father just sold sort of Kevlar vests and things, but his uncle was a real gun dealer to police, to law enforcement, and Divaroli apprenticed to him after he got kicked out of high school. And so he spent about a year or two working for his uncle, and the kid is just a genius. The kid had a native touch for it. You might think of it like computer hackers, just like somebody who has a passion for it and an instinct and an ability. So he set up on his own, like he rented a room from this Latino family in South Beach when he's 16 or 17. I guess by then he was 18. He started up his own company called AEY, and he began to bid on federal arms contracts. Federal law requires that all contracts be placed online at a website called FedBizOps. If any of your listeners want to start dealing arms. It's just that simple. You can go on and start, you know, bidding on contracts. I mean, there's obviously things that you need to do to qualify. And the world of arms, you know, bidding for Pentagon contracts is pretty arcane, and there's lots of forms. This Divaroli kid was just excellent at it. And so he began to bid on small, kind of obscure, hard-to-do contracts that the big companies wouldn't be interested in, like, you know, supplying a couple of hundred AKs from the Soviet Union to train special forces in Germany. Things that, you know, that the huge, you know, all-consuming Fortune 500 companies wouldn't bother to bid on, or wouldn't really, you know how to bid on it as nimbly as he could, because he had no overhead, no staff, no anything. And so he started to win these little contracts.
He was sort of like the Majority Report of arms dealers, in a way.
Yeah, yeah, and aiming to be, you know, Rush Limbaugh.
There you go. And so he builds essentially a track record and a credibility for himself by doing these small-scale jobs.
And yeah, you call it past performance. And pretty soon, within a year, the kid's a millionaire.
Wow.
And he says to his buddy, Packhouse, who's like the smartest kid in their group, and this is, you know, this is a group of smart kids. These, you know, there's a way in which the Times portrayed this, the New York Times story, if anybody remembers it, is like that David Packhouse was a masseuse and that Divaroli was a lunatic. There's lots of ways in which this story doesn't match up with the facts. So this story is much more complicated. They're really bright kids. And so he says to Packhouse, you want to come in with me? And Packhouse says, dude, how much money have you made out of it? And Divaroli, you know, fesses up and says, I've got $2 million in the bank. And, you know, Packhouse is an aspiring musician, but he's, like, doing massages out of Craigslist. He's not sure what to do with himself. He's going to college part-time. So he joins up with Divaroli, and they start to, as a for-commission kind of collaborator, and they start to bid on these various contracts. And Divaroli continues to succeed. Packhouse is struggling as an apprentice. But then, you know, in 2006-07, the Bush administration, and this will, I'm no doubt, give your listeners such pleasure to recall these days.
Yes.
The Bush administration realized that its Afghanistan policy was going to hell in a handcart. And the concern that was later conveyed to these kids is that the Pentagon and the powers that be were worried that a Democrat, if elected, might withdraw from Afghanistan, should we be so lucky, right?
That's the most hilarious aspect of the story, almost.
Yeah,
at this point.
So they decided to basically dump as much ammunition as they could possibly buy into Afghanistan in order to make sure that their, you know, comrades in arms weren't abandoned in the field. You know, needless to say, the blowback from that will last a generation or two.
Right.
So they put out this thing, this solicitation, it's called, for 100 million rounds of AK, 25,000 million drillion RPGs, just literally scour up the entire Eastern Europe, put it on an airplane, and dump it into Afghanistan.
Ugh.
And so this contract is a one, winner-take-all. One bidder, one contract, and so, you know, without a number attached to it, so all these massive companies go out and bid. So you have, you know, 20 companies chasing this, and one of them is AEY. And so this is just David and Ephraim literally in the living room with a volcano, you know, the pot vaporizer?
I've heard of it.
Yeah, sort of a stack of high quality weed, you know, working around the clock, calling up every arms dealing nefarious Eastern European company and getting quotes, getting prices. So, you know, they basically throw in a bid. Divaroli, it's his money, so he's sort of in charge. He doesn't know what to bid. He's like, do I bid 10% margin, 5% margin, 12%? He's trying to guess what the, what price will get him there. He bid $299 million and like $99.99 kind of thing. And we don't know to this day how much he actually beat the next bidder by, but it was on the order of $100
million. Wow. So he underbid his competitors by $100 million in bidding, basically $300 million to deliver all of the loose ammunitions that are floating around Eastern Europe.
As much as they can get. Now, basically, America's foreign policy in Afghanistan, which you could argue, as then-candidate Obama was the single most important foreign policy objective, was in the hand of two stoners, one a high school dropout and one a masseuse.
Oh, my God.
And so they proceeded to try to fulfill this contract. And what the story portrays, and the larger project that I'm working on, which will be a follow-up book, is that you know, the kids become the portal into the world of arms trading, arms dealing, and the nexus of politics and violence, and really, you know, the Technicolor version of the Bush administration, like literally everything that was awful about it, all under one roof, you know, so, including the naivety, the adolescent attitude, the double dealing, the mealy mouthing, and the amorality. I mean, it's an incredible story, and the magazine article really only touches, you know, gives you, I guess, you know, sort of an introduction to, a cliff's note to, and as Sam and I, as we discussed the other day, there's lots of stuff that is yet to emerge that I'm reporting on that'll, I think, point in some very interesting directions. But the essence of it is that the kids imagine themselves to be kind of, you know, latter-day Victor Boots or, you know, Khashoggis.
Right. Now, these guys, they ended up like, I mean, the story, people have to read this because it cannot be done justice. The idea of these guys on the phone freaking out with some guy in.
I'll jump to that real quick. But basically what they do is they fall in with this Swiss guy named Enrique Tomei, who's, you know, who is the real world. He's the actual arms dealer in all this. You know, he's their conduit to the big time deals. And one of them is in Albania. And Albania, if anybody's been there, as I have, you know that it's basically one big arms cache. You know, it was the most paranoid government on earth for decades. So these kids were emptying out Albania under the watchful eye of the State Department and Pentagon. And it all goes really, really wrong when they discover that they're selling Chinese-manufactured ammunition.
Now, why is that a problem?
Because after Tiananmen Square, the American government, in its infinite wisdom, put an embargo on all Chinese-manufactured ammunition. Now, the fact of the matter is that this ammunition was given to Albania in the 1950s and 60s. So you can do the math. That predates Tiananmen Square by decades. So while it is quote-unquote Chinese ammo, in what sense is it really Chinese ammo? You know, when does it become Albanian ammo? The kids, there's lots of ways the kids could have played it, literally 100 ways to play it, and they chose the worst, which was to try to lie and to hide it, to take the ammunition out of its Chinese marked boxes, sardine cans, put it into cardboard boxes, and ship it all to Afghanistan. So that's what happened. It resulted in a local Albanian businessman getting in a dispute with the corrupt Albanian officials, which led to his demise, quote unquote, accidental demise, and that sort of that also proceeded to led to a tip to the New York Times, who then spent a year and 8 different reporters on 4 different continents reporting the story, which resulted in a front page story, which in turn resulted in the indictment of these 3 kids and one older gentleman who had been part of their financial, who'd been a financier for them. And, you know, what you basically have is the story as portrayed is of 2 really, I guess you'd call them idiotic, corrupt, greedy kids and 2 other people who were associated with them trying to victimize the American government and sell crappy ammunition to the innocent Afghanistani army and police.
So it's basically, where's my armaments?
That's the story that the United States Attorney's Office wants you to believe. That's the story that the New York Times covered. It's actually completely and totally wrong. And I hope, as we've discussed, I can't really talk about it yet, but not to be cute, but it suffice to say that the American government was not fooled by this. They were getting what they wanted. And when it became public that what they wanted was crappy Albanian ammunition and they didn't care if it was from China or Paraguay or anywhere. They just wanted the ammo. And when it became apparent that this was the Bush administration's policy, and this will probably be familiar to your listeners, someone had to carry the blame, and it wasn't going to be the Bush administration.
So there's obviously a lot more to this story. This is basically chapter one. I mean, in some ways, it's basically the introduction to this story. It's the story that is...
I mean, I should say there's a lot of cocaine use, sex, swearing, and fun along the way. I mean, if I'm making it sound dry, it's really not. I mean, the story... Which, if you want to read it, you can read it on my website.
Which, again, is also very much why we call this the it's like the majority report of arms dealer stories.
Right, similar to your set. Similar to your set. I don't know if I want to plug it any particular way. It doesn't do me any good. But if anybody wants to read it, it's at my website. It's at GUYLAWSON.com.
Yeah, we will post a link to this. So now, just give me a little bit of background. Like, how did you do your reporting on this? I mean, how did you traveled to Albania? Where else did you travel? Who did you talk to?
What happened was, I read this. I read the New York Times story as you did, and maybe a lot of your listeners did. It just was such an outrageous story, and there was something about it that just didn't ring true. You know, it seemed a little pat that these two teenagers would somehow fool the whole world.
Right.
You know, I mean, you're talking about...
Because these guys actually sat down and they met with Defense Department. It wasn't just like it started
constantly.
In their living room, but they actually had face-to-face contact.
Constant contact. They were chartering hundreds of cargo planes. Tens and fifties and hundreds of millions of dollars was hitting their account. This ammunition was in wide use. It remains in wide use in Afghanistan. It's just, you know, the idea that everybody, you know, it's like the Humphrey Bogart movie, I'm shocked to hear that there's dishonesty and conniving involved in the arms dealing business. Poor American government. So I was talking to my editor at Rolling Stone, and I've been repeatedly covering the Mexican drug wars, and that was getting a little old. So I said, what do you guys want me to do next? Like, what kind of story? And they said, I don't know, young kids doing fucked up things. So I went through the Rolodex of my head, and I thought, this is the best young kids doing. Can you swear on this, on the majority report?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Sorry. What I basically did, it's a bit of a... secret of the trade is that, you know, I used to be a lawyer. I know how the legal process works. And the moment you can approach people to talk to you is when they're right after they've been sentenced, right upon the time they're being sentenced, because all the jeopardy detaches from them. So basically, I went down and to Miami Beach and talked to a defense attorney and to one of the kids. And now I'm going to be in touch with the other of the kids. And so, you know, it was really a matter of having a good sense of timing, or good luck in timing, and then also having the venue, as Rolling Stone does, you know, and I think a lot of your listeners will recognize this, to be critical, and to be to tell stories that, you know, if I was down there for the New York Times, I would not be able to tell the story the way it needs to get told.
Well, listen,
and that's a real criticism, I think, of the press in this age.
Absolutely,
and how complicit it is.
All right, well, Guy, it's an amazing story, and we're looking forward to the book and the update. But thank you so much for joining us. The website is GuyLawson.com. We'll have a link at majority.fm.
Can I just put in one little plug?
Please.
Yeah, you know, I'm starting a for your listeners out there, I'm starting a draft Mark Green for mayor.
Well done. Yes. Well, we'll certainly have you on to talk about that. Maybe we could have a debate.
Go get him, Sam.
All right, Guy, thank you so much for joining us.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Sam Cedar. He puts the truth inside your radio.
The reason why we have those conspiracy theories is because there's a certain lack of transparency, and when you have a void, when you have an absence of information, that vacuum is filled. I remember distinctly saying to, maybe it was Ciro,
Maybe it was Rosen. I can't remember. But at one point, walking around Air America, saying to a board op, you know, this is like 2008, 2009, saying to somebody like, you know, it would be irrational for some of our listeners not to think there was a mole in Air America, because there's almost virtually no other explanation for how poorly this place is run. It just so happens that up close, I can see that it's sort of like, it's not quite that nefarious. It's a sort of a combination of wrong personnel and total incompetence and self-serving decisions. But I said, like, you know, like I understand more about projecting certain conspiracies onto situations based upon how it would look from the outside, because it's almost inexplicable, and I'm right in the middle of it, and I see it every day, and I could not sit there and draw a clear diagram on how fucked up this place is. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Is that, like, you can, like, I don't know how somebody from the outside couldn't look at that and go, like, somebody's purposely trying to sabotage it from within.
It's like you can't even make it up. It's so...
And, you know, because there's no transparency there, people make that determination because, and it wouldn't be a rational guess. I mean, you know, I still have my questions about some of those guys in there.
Some people are doing just fine today that were there.
Right. Well, and it's a, you know.
Because of being there, you know.
Well, but what I'm talking about is you have people there who, you know, let's use the initials S.E. Okay, you know what I'm talking about. He was one of the longest-running employees there. His politics were definitely, you know, definitely to the right of center, as most of the actual executives were over time.
Pinstripe suits.
Well, Bennett Zier, the only political contribution I could find for him was to Mitt Romney. He was the last CEO of Air America. That's public knowledge. You can find that. But most of these guys, more than anything, at the end of the day, maybe they had disdain for the people who worked there because they were liberals, which I think is true. Certainly of Bennett Zier. He definitely hated everyone there because they were liberal. It was real contempt. And, you know, when people say to me, like, you shouldn't say stuff, you know, when you mock, you know, someone wrote to me, like, when you mock the South, not Larry Sabato said this to me on Twitter. You know, part of the reason why people vote against, one party is because they think it's full of elites who make fun of them, because I made that joke about the South. Well, I got news for you. This motherfucker, Bennett Zier, came in with a, I don't know, how much does a watch like that go for? $1,000? Shoes cost $700. Suits cost $1,000. Walks in Washington, going to every elite function, whatever it was. There's no way Bennett Zier is less of an elite than me. Okay? And he loathed, not just me, but like you, Dorsey, the grubbiness. He'd walk around and say, like, this isn't the Peace Corps. What the fuck does that mean?
Every day he would walk through the intern row where I, you know, sat with the interns, and he would clap his hands together, saving the world today. We're going to save the world today.
With derision. His visceral hatred was not about we think that we are elites. It's him projecting, and this is the perfect insight into the conservative mind. It is them projecting. Maybe accurately, maybe not, projecting upon others that they are judging me. This, in other words, Bennett is judging everybody from the lowly intern to Dorsey to anybody else. You think you're better than me because you give a shit about other people. That's what's in the conservative mind. And that's why when you listen to Limbaugh or any other conservative radio show, the message is you don't need to care about other people. And those other people who are do-gooders, they're not better than you. They think they're better than you. So elite is simply a code word for people who actually think about other people instead of themselves. And These guys weren't trying to tear down Air America because they were liberal. They hated the people there because they were liberal. But they were just basically just trying to make a buck. And were doing it in the way that they knew how, which was to enrich their buddies in the radio industry. So when it comes time to sending out a mailer, what am I going to do? Am I going to spend the money in a smart way, get help from, shops that do mailers, you know, that are willing to give us a discount rate because they agree with our politics and they've been doing this professionally in the context of, you know, like political consulting? Or am I going to go to the same hack who does Clear Channel, who may be in a position to hire me when I'm at, you know, the local easy listening station? Easy choice. Yeah, it'll fuck up and fail. Our ratings may even go down after this mailer. We waste $500,000. But so what? I don't give a shit about the bottom line of this company. I care about my bottom line. And the biggest irony I ever, you know, faced there was when one of the owners said to me, you know, Sam, you're not a team player. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Are you fucking kidding me? Do you know how many times I skipped a check at the beginning of this place? How many times I took bounce checks? How many times I did, you know, the shit that I've done? When they say you're not a team player, what they're saying is, like, you're not on our executive team. Our team, we have different rules than the team that makes the success of the company. Oh, right. Your team is supposed to bilk you out. I mean, what this guy didn't realize is that the team that he thought I wasn't on was bilking him of money. Bilking him. We are back. This is the Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar. On the phone, we have a, as reported in by WTOP.com, WTOP, I guess a local, or WUSA9 in Virginia. On the phone, Loudoun County lawmaker Gene Sniffa, a Republican representing Sterling on the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors. Welcome to the program, Mr. Sniffa.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here on such a dismal occasion, sadly, but it's still a pleasure.
I'm sorry, what, a dismal occasion?
I'm sorry. When you're watching the United States of America go down the toilet in such a fashion as it has, well, certainly over the last 20 years, 30 years since the hippie movement, and now today becoming a one-sex society, it's just, it's depressing. The work is tireless.
Excuse me for 1 second. I just want to, you have a very specific issue with the TSA new program using the Rapiscan. And if you don't use the Rapiscan, you are subject to pat-downs. And you have a rather odd perspective on this, if you don't mind my saying.
Well, you know, I mean, I've heard people refer to my perspective as odd, and I question those people, and I question you, Mr. Cedar. But, yes, I have been conducting an ongoing investigative study myself and several interns have passed through no fewer than 769 different security operations throughout these United States.
So wait, are you suggesting now, okay, so you've been through 700 some odd security checkpoints at airports?
Bypassing the Rapiscan and doing the manual search, that's correct.
What was your findings on this?
My findings are is that the homosexual agenda in this country has effectively committed a coup d'etat in terms of forwarding their agenda, their ideals, their lifestyle, and their sickness, quite frankly, through this so-called safety security measure. It's a ruse. It's yet another example of how people buck the system and then have and take advantage of young people, old people. I mean, I've already been a victim of this, and I'm quite
frank.
Could
you please explain to my audience why you think this security system is part of the homosexual agenda?
What better opportunity for a person of same sex to place their hands upon the genitalia, the privates of another person, for a little bit of a thrill? Oh, sure, we're going to keep you safe. At first, I just was shocked that, my goodness, I've been touched in a place that my wife barely touches me. And I'm thinking, that's odd. I don't even know this gentleman. On first appearances, he seems kindly enough.
Wait a second. Are you suggesting that the homosexual agenda was to set up these security things?
I'm proving it. I'm not suggesting it. I've proven it. On three different occasions just this week, I became more aroused during a security check than I've ever been in my life. Embarrassing, yes. Necessary, of course. But I'm not the only one. This is happening to young boys. This is happening possibly to young girls.
Wait a second.
Go ahead.
You're suggesting that because you were sexually aroused that these people, this is part of the gay agenda.
If it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody. Understand that I was raised Christian. I volunteered at my church, and I still am involved in the youth group. I run all the campouts. I do all the picnics. I do all the youth-oriented work. From there, I was a member of the Boy Scouts of America. Still am a card-carrying member of the Baden-Powell Council. I am as normal can be in these United States. And if I'm being aroused when a person of my own sex begins to fiddle and fondle and faddle my private area, I will tell you what, it can happen to anybody. I'm sickened by it. I'm embarrassed by it. But I feel my work is necessary work to stop the homosexual agenda. And these body searches, these manual... Do you know how many machines are now technically down? Sorry, our machine isn't working. Come this way.
How many more of these searches do you intend to engage in?
As many as it takes. If I have to go through one every day, I'll do it for the United States of America. I don't mind sacrificing myself like Mr. Rush Limbaugh, like Mr. Ronald Reagan, and Mr. Sean Hannity. I am of the idea that this is a great country, and it could be even greater. But many of us have to say the things we need to say and do the things we need to do. I will gladly throw myself on a grenade, so to speak. But in this case, it happens to be the wandering hands of a homosexual.
Well, sir, Loudoun County lawmaker Gene Sniffa, thank you so much for joining us. I don't know.
I don't find anything at all humorous about this situation.
Forgive me, sir. Good day to you.
One moment.
Oh my God. Wow. All right. I don't know what to say. It's a WUSA 9. I think if you look it up, you can see Virginia lawmaker claims pat downs part of a homosexual agenda. Wouldn't be on the internet if it wasn't true, ladies and gentlemen.